to the court. We have two cases today. The first case is United States v. Cole. Major Goldseth, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Wright, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Major Samantha Goldseth, and I represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Christopher Cole. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The military judge in this case advised Airman Cole of incorrect elements and definitions. He then asked Airman Cole about those incorrect elements and definitions and ultimately determined that those elements were met. The government concedes this error, and this error is an error of constitutional magnitude. And Airman Cole was prejudiced by the military judge's incorrect understanding of the offense because the military judge sentenced Airman Cole while believing that the offense was a more aggravated offense than it was, and a more aggravated offense than the facts or law of this case, in this case, support.
Now, in regard to the standard, you refer to this error as being of a constitutional magnitude, and therefore that the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard applies. But that issue wasn't raised before the trial court or before the CCA, was it?
Your Honor, it was not. However, the issue itself was developed at the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, and that issue being whether the military judge erred and whether that prejudiced Airman Cole, and ultimately this court should apply the correct standard.
Well, is that question, though, whether it was of a constitutional magnitude, within the scope of the granted issue?
Your Honor, it is, because the issue itself is whether Airman Cole was prejudiced. And the standard, how we assess that prejudice, is up to this court to decide. That's the correct legal standard that this court should decide. And I can point this court back to, for example, United States versus Edwards. Similarly, in that case, the appellant also had not raised the constitutional nature of the issue at the Court of Criminal Appeals, and yet this court considered that issue and should do the same here, because ultimately the issue itself was developed at the Court of Criminal Appeals, and it is now up to this court to apply the correct standard to that issue in determining or analyzing the prejudice here.
In your view, let's say for the sake of argument that this court were to disagree, could you still prevail if we used the ordinary standard, plain error?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason why, first I'll start with the fact that the government has conceded the error here and has not contested that it is that this was not plain error. And the plain error can also be seen from review of the elements that the military judge gave. Those are detailed on appellant's brief at page 18. The review of the elements that were given by the military judge and the definitions demonstrate that clear error here. Moreover, when we get to the prejudice here, while appellant contests that this is an error of constitutional magnitude, should this court review it at a lower level, we can look at what the military judge said in this case. We understand from United States versus Day that what the military judge says to the accused during the plea colloquy matters. So here, when we had the stipulation of fact and other documents that were drafted by, for example, trial counsel, that's when the military judge is reviewing that, that's not his own words. But when we look to the plea colloquy, what the military judge is asking Airman Cole in this case, we can see what the military judge believed was not only closely connected to this offense, but what he believed was necessary for this offense, what elements he believed needed to be satisfied. And here, under Rosales-Morales from the Supreme Court, we know that any amount of additional jail time is significant. So if Airman Cole received even a day more confinement than he otherwise should have, that would be prejudice. And we know that when the military judge was reviewing this issue, was assessing what the sentence should be going into sentencing, he believed that not only two additional aggravated elements applied, But in getting to the legal conclusion that those aggravated elements applied, he believed that there was also a factual determination here that the unloaded firearm was capable of causing death or grievous bodily harm. He could not have got to the determination that this was a dangerous weapon had he not decided that this was capable of that. So he went into sentencing understanding the bare elements, but also these additional aggravated elements that did not apply in this offense. And we know that military judges have considerable discretion in sentencing, and that considerable discretion existed even here within this plea agreement. And the military judge, when he was assessing that sentence, had to have been swayed by that additional evidence that this was not just a unloaded firearm, but that there was a greater intent here, and that this was a, despite this court's law in United States versus Davis, and despite there being no facts to support that this weapon could be used for this greater harm, that he believed that was so.
Now you say that the military judge had to be affected by that. How do we know that? And is that actually the correct standard? Do we, as a court, have to know that that is what the military judge would have done here? He would have done something differently if he had correctly understood what the offense was that this accused was pleading guilty to.
No, Your Honor. Even under the lesser standard, there would only have to be a reasonable probability that the sentence that Airman Cole received was substantially influenced by this error. And here, we can see that there's a foreseeable tendency that his sentence would have been greater due to the aggravated view that the military judge held of the facts and of the offense that were not accurate. And we can look to United States versus Langston about the principle that the accused admissions are the strongest form of evidence. And here, again, the military judge thought this was necessary to this crime, and he was using this, the strongest form of evidence, to believe that the nature of the offense was greater than it was. And when we look to Specification 7 as a comparison, while the facts are different, we can see that there, the military judge gave Airman Cole the minimum sentence, versus here, where he misunderstood the offense, he gave the maximum punishment. And in that offense, Specification 7, there was actual harm to the victim, harm that included physical harm that required a third party to intervene, medical intervention, and then continuing medical treatment through physical therapy afterwards. And there, he still gave the minimum punishment. Which,
Counsel, on that point, you mean he gave the minimum that would be the maximum punishment if it was simple assault for which he was sentencing him?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, when you're comparing the two, he understood that the maximum sentence for simple assault was 3 years, but we don't know that he was sentencing the accused for simple assault. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor, to a point. The thing is, we don't know exactly how the military judge got to the ultimate understanding of what the maximum punishment was in this case. We know that there was an RCM 802 conference, and that conference likely occurred because, making an assumption here, they needed to discuss what potential punishment could be applied to Specification 1, which was aggravated assault via strangulation, because at the time of that offense, there was not a maximum punishment prescribed by the president. And so that's likely why that 802 happened, but nowhere on the record does anyone explain how these maximum punishment for all of the offenses have been determined. So we don't know that what the military judge believed the maximum punishment for this offense was. It seems as though he could have believed it was the same maximum punishment for aggravated assault with a dangerous weapon, because those are the elements that he read and the definitions he read to Airman Cole.
Oh, I'm sorry. Major Goseth, is the error that the judge committed that he believed it was a loaded weapon, or it was an unloaded weapon? Or was the mistake simply he said dangerous weapon Because he had the charge sheet in front of him, and the charge sheet indicates that it's an unloaded weapon, so.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we have any facts that tell us that the military judge believed it was a loaded firearm. But the error here exists nonetheless because the military judge.
No, I'm not questioning the error. I agree with you, and apparently everyone concedes that there's an error. But the effect of this error, I guess, is what I'm trying to understand what your claim is. The effect was what?
Yes,
if he knew it was an unloaded firearm, then isn't the military judge sentencing the individual based on the facts that come out of the plea inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor. So first, I would say the military judge did not understand the offense, despite the fact that he understood it was an unloaded firearm, and I can point to several points for that.
Mm-hmm.
But the military judge didn't understand the facts when he went into sentencing. And that's because here, again, we know.
But he had the charge sheet in front of him. Isn't that the only fact that's relevant in the issue you've presented to us? Is whether the firearm was loaded or unloaded. It says it was unloaded. He made the mistake in either mentioning or thinking that it was loaded, but the facts that come out indicate that it's an unloaded firearm.
Your Honor, the military judge believed it was a dangerous weapon, mm-hmm. and the fact that he knew it was unloaded did not change that determination for him.
Okay.
So the fact that he went through the stipulation of fact and repeated multiple times that he knew it was an unloaded firearm does not change that he ultimately decided that it was capable of death or grievous bodily harm, and that it was therefore a dangerous weapon. So when he went into sentencing for Airman Cole, that fact did not exist in the record and it was not supported by the law, and yet he sentenced Airman Cole under that incorrect understanding. And Your Honor, to go back to the charge sheet, that is one of the many examples of how we can see the military judge should not be given that deference that we would usually give here, because the record is littered with errors. The military.
Well, I'm not saying you should get any deference. I think we already know we made a mistake, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think this is more getting to the prejudice piece of this, of whether he understood the offense. We know he didn't understand the offense because, for example, the charge sheet, it doesn't actually list there the name of the offense. Neither did the stipulation of fact. There were non-particular.
Let me go back just a minute, though. But to my question, I'm wondering why we can't just look at what the military judge brought out as the facts and conclude that the sentence was assessed or judged based on the facts that came out during the inquiry. Why can't that be the case? Why is it as much a problem on prejudice or not, whether or not he used these other definitions, if what ultimately he sentenced the accused on were the facts that came out of the plea inquiry? Maybe you don't agree with me that that's what the only thing he should be sentencing him on. Is that some of the problem you and I have?
No, Your Honor. I think the issue is that the military judge did not understand the facts. He might have understood some of them, but he did not understand all of them when he went into sentencing. So here he understood the firearm was unloaded, and yet he believed it was a dangerous weapon capable of death or grievous bodily harm. And so when he went into sentencing and needed to sentence Airman Cole for the nature of this offense, he was doing so under an aggravated view of that offense that did not exist in the facts. And it's not just his legal determinations. It's also the fact that he has believed exists in this case that does not. And it is that further step there of mm-hmm. that this weapon, though unloaded, was capable of death or grievous bodily injury. And that has that foreseeable tendency to aggravate this offense for the military judge when he's sentencing Airman Cole, believing that additional facts and elements applied here when they did not.
Okay.
And Your Honor, in addition to this, there, I would contest that this is a, there are multiple places where the government has tried to argue in their brief that the military judge really did understand the offense. For example, pointing to the defense incident-based report code that was on the entry of judgment. I would point out that the military judge does not draft that document. We know that because in the scheduling order for this case, trial counsel was tasked with doing that. And even within the four corners of that document, we can see the lack of attention to detail from this military judge. He hasn't updated the date of the document. He's simply signed it. In addition to that, that document...
And counsel, on that point, the document is prepared after the trial is over.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or it's filled out and signed by the judge afterwards.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. However, I will also point out that according to the scheduling order, the statement of trial results and the entry of judgment were both due to the military judge prior to trial. And like the stipulation of fact, had the military judge reviewed the statement of trial results or the draft entry of judgment before going into the care inquiry or the providence inquiry with Aaron Cole, it made no difference because he still asked these questions, advised Aaron Cole of the wrong elements and definitions. And so that shows us all of these other documents that were drafted by other individuals, they may have understood the offense here, but the military judge did not, because it was he who chose what questions to ask during that providence inquiry, and it was he who believed these elements and definitions were necessary. And if I may, Your Honors, I would like to get to the fact that why the questions he asked were not closely connected to the charged offense and why this court should review this and find that it is an error of constitutional magnitude. So we know from Holt and Price, for example, that the military judge is allowed to ask about the factual basis of an offense. He needs to make sure there's a detailed factual basis for the offense. And that's what this court found in United States versus Price, was that the military judge's questions were getting at the elements of the offense. Here, the military judge was asking questions about elements that do not apply to this offense, and so therefore he was outside he should not be given substantial deference, one, because he was asking about elements that did not apply to this offense, but like this court has explained in United States versus Holt, when those questions are not closely connected, he has gone beyond Airman Cole's waiver of his right against self-incrimination here. And that's why this is an error of constitutional magnitude.
But he's not convicted of anything he wasn't charged with or was trying to plead guilty to, right?
That's correct.
We're only talking about sentencing here.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the fact that the military judge violated his right against self-incrimination shows that
was the prejudice from that? What did he plead? What did he admit doing that got him in more trouble?
Your Honor, I see my time has run. May I answer?
Please do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, he agreed with the military judge's questions about the elements and definitions here that were incorrect. And in doing so, the military judge used those admissions to find that the factual basis had been met of these incorrect aggravated elements to include that there was intent to cause bodily harm and that there had been a dangerous weapon used in this offense. And so it is the military judge then takes that into sentencing and uses that against Airman Cole in deciding his sentence, which we know from Estelle v. Smith that should not have been considered in sentencing.
But you're not suggesting that any confusion or errors during sentencing are of a constitutional magnitude?
Your Honor, I'm contesting that the issue was raised during findings and then used against him in sentencing, much like was the case in Estelle v. Smith before the Supreme Court. There, when the questions were asked of the individual to ascertain what his potential sentencing could look like, it was then used against him in sentencing later. So the same would apply here, where the military judge was eliciting this information on the incorrect elements from Aaron Cole during the care inquiry and then used that in sentencing when he misunderstood the nature of the offense for which he was sentencing him.
Any further questions?
Can I ask one question?
Please do.
In your brief, you suggest the remedy would be either to remand for resentencing or to have the Court of Criminal Appeals reassess the sentence. If he was sentenced for an offense that he didn't commit, why would having the Court of Criminal Appeals reassess the sentence be an appropriate remedy?
Your Honor, because the error here is in the military judge's understanding of the offense in sentencing, so having the Court of Criminal Appeals determine how to send this back potentially to the trial level would allow for that addition, that resentencing, that where the.
Well, I agree. I can understand why resentencing would be an appropriate remedy, but you suggested that merely having the CCA reassess the sentence would be appropriate. I'm wondering how that's consistent with your theory.
Your Honor, I will concede. I believe that the appropriate remedy here is resentencing. However, I believed it was also inappropriate to address the Winkleman factors at this court, understanding that that's something that would probably happen at the Court of Criminal Appeals. However, should this court, I do believe the appropriate remedy here is that there should be a resentencing because the military judge did not understand the nature of the offense, and that should occur for there to be a fair sentencing for Airman Cole.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Major Goldseth, because your time has expired, I'd like to pose a question to you, but ask that you address it when you come back up.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is, what holding, if we were to agree with you, if this court, hypothetically, were to agree with your position, what holding should this case stand for? If there is instruction for military judges, trial counsel, defense counsel in the future, and the instructor were to say, Cole stands for this proposition, what is that proposition? And I'd like you to please address that when you come back up.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Captain Wright.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Jocelyn Wright, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. This court should affirm the Air Force Court's decision for two reasons. First, the military judge's errors were neutralized because his errors did not change the factual landscape that the military judge used to sentence appellant. Despite the errors, the military judge still knew that appellant could not have used the firearm to shoot the victim, and knew appellant did not actually physically injure the victim.
Captain Wright, let me stop you for just a minute here. Usually at the end of the plea inquiry, and maybe they don't do this anymore. It's been a long time since I was on the bench. Some would say too long, but. At the end of the plea inquiry, doesn't the judge ask counsel, is there anything further you would like me to address? Or goes to defense counsel or the trial counsel? Do you know if that happened in this case?
It did, Your Honor, and no one objected. Neither trial counsel nor defense counsel objected.
All right, then let me ask you this question. Is the trial counsel deemed to be in charge of ensuring that the record will be complete at the end of the plea inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so what's the problem? Everybody scared of the judge or sleep at the wheel? What's going on here?
Your Honor, the dangerous weapon element was mentioned at the very beginning of the care inquiry, but not reiterated anywhere else. Even the trial counsel did not use it in their sentencing argument.
Right, but shouldn't someone, when they hear the judge saying that, oh, wait a minute, Judge, it's not a dangerous weapon, it's an unloaded firearm. How come no one, and I'm not beating up on you because you aren't there, but I'm just wondering if you have a notion or an idea of why everybody's kind of watching the judge commit this mistake.
Your Honor, I can only speculate as to why.
Please do.
Please speculate. Yes, Your Honor. I think it was simply in real time, it was a quick error that was just missed. Because again, it wasn't reiterated by the military judge. The facts that were provided by appellant in his care inquiry did not discuss dangerous weapon and made very clear that the gun was not only unloaded, but inoperable because the firing pin had been removed.
Well, that makes it worse then, doesn't it? For the military judge, not only is the gun unloaded, it's inoperable, and here he is thinking it's a dangerous weapon?
It is worse for the military judge, but the facts he knew for certain was that it was unloaded and that it couldn't have hurt the victim. And he repeated that information multiple times during the care inquiry. It was repeated in the stipulation of fact as well. between the appellant and the military judge, it was said approximately 19 times that the gun did not work.
You keep saying that, and nobody's disputing that he didn't know that the gun was unloaded. But, like, so he got some facts right, but he had some facts, some important facts wrong. I mean, so he gets a C, and then we decide whether C work is prejudicial to the appellant? No one's disputing he knew the gun was unloaded. Right? And as Judge Sparks just said, that seems to make it worse, because now he's confused. Like, why is he asking about whether or not it's a dangerous weapon?
He should not have been asking that, Your
Honor. Right. Great.
Absolutely.
Right. So he's confused, right? I don't know how to read anything into that other than he's confused about the offenses that he's sentencing the appellant for and what the elements of those offenses are. Now, that seems troubling. I guess the question is it so troubling that it was prejudicial to the appellant? And now we get into this area of, like, well, how do we know? I think it's pretty well established that there was confusion. It didn't bother the CCA. Your job is to convince us that it shouldn't bother us either. So if we can all agree that the military judge was confused when he was sentencing the appellant, why should we not be convinced that that confusion raised to the level of prejudice?
The government concedes that the military judge was confused and that he erred. But he was sentencing him, or any reasonable judge would sentence an individual for the nature and circumstances of the offense itself. And here we have facts.
But he's confused about the nature of the offense. Now, you're saying he knew the facts that happened on the ground, and maybe that's true, but he thinks he committed, or he seems to think he committed assault with a dangerous weapon, and that he had the intent to do bodily harm, which are elements of a more serious crime.
The military judge, though, did, even if he was confused on those facts, he still knew the other robust facts that were provided in the care inquiry and in the stipulation of fact, that the firearm was pointed at the victim, that the victim thought she was going to die, and that later on, when reiterating the facts to a friend, he laughed about it, showing a lack of remorse immediately after. Those facts, a reasonable judge could find 6 months as an appropriate sentence, because simple assault with an unloaded firearm has a maximum of 3 years.
I don't even think the appellant disagrees with that, because that was within the plea agreement, right? He was signed up for up to 6 months.
Yes, right? Sir.
But what we don't know is why it was six instead of five or three or any of the other amounts that was permissible under the plea agreement. And that's what we're trying to figure out here. I don't think anyone's arguing that the sentence was improper or illegal. We're just trying to figure out what to do about the fact that the military judge was confused.
But when we're looking at the prejudice standard, whether or not there's a reasonable probability that but for the error, the outcome would have been different, though the military judge may have mistook this as a dangerous weapon, ultimately he knew it was unloaded and could not have actually caused grievous bodily harm. And he's sentencing on the facts, not necessarily the title of the offense or the erroneous elements and definitions. We don't know, an appellant doesn't know for sure, but ultimately there's a reasonable probability based on these facts that the sentence of 6 months would have still stood.
Counsel,
go ahead.
On that point, suppose the military judge had been crystal clear in what the military judge said and said, I'm giving you 6 months sentence for committing the offense of aggravated assault with a dangerous weapon, an offense he hadn't been convicted of. I mean, he didn't say that. And the question is, did he understand that it was simple assault, or did he understand it was aggravated assault with a dangerous weapon? But if he had said, and I'm giving you 6 months because I found you guilty of aggravated assault with a dangerous weapon, would we look at prejudice, or would we just say, look, there can't be any sentence for an offense that he hasn't been convicted of?
Your Honor, at that point, we would have an issue with the providency of the plea.
Well, no, he finds the person guilty, and all the elements are covered. But then he says, for this offense, which you didn't commit, I'm sentencing you to 6 months. I mean, wouldn't we just simply say, well, you can't get any sentence for an offense you didn't commit or that you haven't been found guilty of?
If all of the facts for aggravating, or if the plea essentially was provident for aggravated assault in your scenario, Your Honor, then yes, he should not be sentenced for something that he wasn't convicted of. However, the plea inquiry in this case, so the providency of the plea is not before this court. The facts in the plea inquiry support the simple assault with an unloaded firearm, and the Air Force Court only affirmed the finding of simple assault with an unloaded firearm. So in this situation, we're looking at the prejudice based on the simple assault with an unloaded firearm, which has the same, though there was an error in the military judge's initial care inquiry, the maximum sentence for both offenses is the same. It was capped in the same manner with the plea agreement, and the facts that came out, again, supported simple assault with an unloaded firearm.
Thank you. May I change my subject, which is that in looking at the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion, it seemed like they cited only two things that suggested that the court knew that this was, they were sentencing, the military judge knew that it was sentencing the accused for simple assault. One was that they got the maximum sentence correct, and two was that they entered the data code correctly after trial on the sheet. Is that the only, what else should the Court of Criminal Appeals have cited besides those two facts?
I don't know that the Air Force Court needed to cite additional.
Well, I'm just asking you, is there anything, if I'm not convinced by those two facts, is there anything else that should convince me?
Yes, Your Honor. First, that the military judge and the parties, again, knew the firearm was unloaded and inoperable. The military judge never elicited from appellant that he actually harmed the victim in this case, or that he truly intended to commit bodily harm. He asked if pointing the firearm at her was bodily harm, which we agree is an error, but then went on to ask if he intended to point the firearm at her, which is a way, though possibly inartful, to get to the offer element of the offense, and to ensure that there was no accident.
Isn't it also a way to get to the intent aspect of the aggravated assault? I mean, he used the word intent, and so, I mean, yeah, as opposed to you're arguing, well, he was trying to get to the offer element, and he used the word intent coupled with dangerous weapon tends to make one believe that he was walking his way through the elements of aggravated assault with a dangerous weapon.
And though he may have erred, Your Honor, there is a world in which a reasonable military judge would ask that question to ensure that there's not an accident defense, where he accidentally pointed the firearm at the victim instead of intentionally doing so, to offer that apprehension, Your Honor. In addition to...
Captain Wright, I'd like to pose to you the same question I posed to appellant's counsel. If this court were to agree with your position, what would be the holding in this case? 3 years hence, when they're teaching this case to military judges, defense counsel, trial counsel, what is the proposition? What is the point they should take away from this opinion if we were to agree with the government's approach?
Your Honor, it is important to send a message that care is necessary during a care inquiry, during a plea inquiry. However, we need not overturn or set aside appellant's or reassess appellant's sentence because of the error. But by just granting on this issue, it has warned military judges to take extra care in their inquiries with appellants or with accused.
I'm not sure I hear a holding in that response.
Your Honor, the holding should be affirm the Air Force Court's decision that there was no prejudice, but take care when inquiring about offenses and when determining the sentence. But this court need not reassess or remand for reassessment of the sentence to do so.
Now, you used the word message at the beginning. I'd like to turn it around against you here. Might the message be that when there are multiple errors by the military judge, trial counsel, sits there, says nothing, and defense counsel does as well, and the accused meekly goes along with what's happening there. But when there's the multiple issues that, when it comes up to this court, instead of fixing the problems that are there, that we're taking the approach of good enough for government work, that we shouldn't expect that service members have the right to a process that is completely compliant or reasonably compliant with what needs to happen in a care inquiry and so forth.
Though there were errors in this case, Your Honor, we still need to hold appellant accountable for his actions that he pled guilty to and were found to be provident. That is still a component in this case.
But wouldn't that happen with the remedies posed by appellant's counsel? We're not saying everything's overturned, can't try him again, something like double jeopardy or so forth. The remedy they're looking for is either send it back for resentencing or have the CCA reassess the sentence here. And let's assume for a moment that there's some sense of agreement that what this person did, the accused did, is very serious. Why is there any belief on your part that this person is going to go free in any sense of that term?
We don't believe he will go free, Your Honor. But the Air Force Court is only permitted to affirm what is correct in law and fact. They identified this issue, evaluated this issue, and ultimately determined that appellant was not prejudiced. Sending it back to the Air Force Court will essentially not add any new reassessment. They've already determined that the sentence was correct in law. And
so then you're saying what is the harm to the government here then?
Expediency, Your Honor, and the interest in justice and ensuring.
Now, when you say interest in justice, again, when you're talking about expediency, certainly that's a consideration that we have in terms of judicial resources and so forth, but at what point do we say that expediency outweighs the right of an accused to have some semblance of good order in the course of the care inquiry? That's a line I'm trying to draw in my own mind here.
Understood, Your Honor. And that's where the prejudice analysis comes in to determine justice for appellant. With regard to the outcome in this case and the potential remedy, the government does not believe that this should be returned to the Air Force Court for purposes of expediency and finality for the government as well as the victim in this case.
Now, as appellant's counsel pointed out, this particular military judge, when dealing with an offense that actually resulted in physical injury that required medical treatment, only sentenced the accused to 2 months. So how do we know if he had properly understood what the offense was in terms of what the accused was pleading guilty to, that he might not have gone below 6 months? This was not at least as we usually say in courts, this military judge did not seem to be a long ball hitter. So how do we know that in this case, based on how he handled the sentence in the other offense, that he might have gone to 5 months rather than six? And any amount of time is harmful to the accused.
Looking at Specification 7, it's assault consummated by a battery where appellant twisted her arm behind her back. There was injury in that case, but she did not believe that she was going to die. As opposed to the simple assault with an unloaded firearm, she believed she was going to die, which when someone has a belief that they're truly going to die, he will pull that trigger, and he had already shown a disregard for her person 1 week before by strangling her twice. That informed the victim's understanding of what he was capable of. That is worse than an injury to the body. And the president has determined that it is worse because the maximum sentence for simple assault with an unloaded firearm is 3 years, whereas the maximum for assault consummated by a battery is 6 months.
But the military judge seemed to be under the impression that there was the actual intent on the part of the accused. And that, of course, is not part of simple assault.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. It is not part of simple assault. But he specifically asked about the intent to point the firearm at her, which, when we look at it from a perspective of a reasonable judge may have asked that question, again, to eliminate a defense or to determine that he meant to point it at her. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't a joke, something of that nature. Barring any additional questions, may I briefly conclude?
Any further questions from the bench? Then please conclude.
Appellant's substantial rights were not prejudiced when he was sentenced for pointing an unloaded firearm at the victim's head, despite the military judge's errors. This court should affirm the decision of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Thank you,
Captain Wright. Major Golseth.
Thank you, Your Honor. Beginning first with your question of what the holding should be in this case. The holding should be that everyone in the courtroom needs to be aware of the elements of the offense. And the military judge needed to understand the nature of the offense. This military judge did not, and Airman Cole was prejudiced. Therefore, the sentence should be set aside. I'd like next to discuss the fact that the government and the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals here both have posited that the military judge could not have found that the unloaded firearm was used to inflict death or grievous bodily harm, and that can be found in the Air Force Court's opinion at JA 28 and 29. And we know from the record that that's not the case, because the military judge, again, he chose what elements were necessary for him to advise Airman Cole on. He believed this was a necessary element of the offense, and he then found that it was met. And in order to do so, he would have had to have found that factual issue that this was capable of being used to inflict death or grievous bodily harm. And to get to the government's point here that the military judge did not, in fact, ask about intent for bodily harm, this again points that is also incorrect, because the military judge believed that was an element of the offense, advised Airman Cole on it, asked about it, and then most importantly, determined that element had been met. So the military judge believed that was the nature of this offense when he entered sentencing. Turning to Judge Sparks' question, Your Honor, you asked whether here trial counsel had asked if there was anything further, whether any further questions should be asked. And I think this is, especially when we think back to United States versus Miller, the element of officiality that exists in this courtroom. The military judge is seated in the robe and is the most experienced attorney in the courtroom. All of the attorneys in this room were implicitly relying on the military judge to ask the correct elements. And on that point, I would also like to point out that
I wasn't suggesting that is in any way relevant, to whether the accused is prejudiced or not. I was just simply curious.
Yes, Your Honor.
As to how this came about, given the fact that there are two lawyers and a judge sitting in the courtroom. That was my problem with it.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would state that though it has not been raised, there has been no waiver in this case. When the military judge asked that, the question was whether any additional questions should be asked, not whether there was agreement with the elements or definitions that had been provided. And if this court looks back to United States versus Shell or United States versus Price.
I also wasn't suggesting that the defense counsel had waived anything. The defense counsel has no duty to speak up at that point. She should, but the trial counsel certainly should.
Yes, Your Honor.
So your time has expired. Any further questions from the bench?
I just wanted to clarify based upon that, but it's still your position that these errors raise to the level or have constitutional implications. That's still your position. I just wanted to make sure.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if I may, for
please.
Thank you, Your Honor. For two reasons. First, because this violated Airman Cole's right against self-incrimination, because the questions from the military judge were not for the purpose of getting to the factual basis for the charged offense. And the factual basis for the reason military judges get such discretion for getting to a factual basis is because they have to have a detailed care inquiry for the factual basis of the offense. And an offense is defined by its elements. So here the military judge was not within that lane of getting to the factual basis of the elements. And then secondly, because Airman Cole was not on notice of this fact that the military judge was going to then sentence him for an aggravated offense that he was not charged with.
Any further questions? Thank you. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
Court stands in recess until 10:25.